Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. We're very fortunate tonight to have Benji Molina, who is a catcher with great experience, principally with the California Angels, sometimes called the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, and better known to most of us with the San Francisco Giants. Yeah. And I guess I shouldn't leave out the Texas Rangers just for historic accuracy. But the other guest is, of course, Joan Ryan, who's known to you many for her roles in journalism in the Bay Area. Joan was a beat writer covering the A's and the Giants in the 80s and then had turned into a very prolific author and acts as a consultant to the Giants with regard to media relations, particularly for the players. So, right.
Thank you.
That's this sometimes called how not to Twitter after a bad loss.
Yeah, exactly.
So I want to mention...
And Roy.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I forgot.
Yay!
Yeah. I always forget that. And I want to mention, because it's a very important sponsor, that the club has a Good Lit series of which this is a part, and that is underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation, and we're very appreciative for that underwriting. So we are here tonight to discuss a whole range of things, but they principally rotate around a book that Joan and Benji wrote together of the title Molina, which is a... How did you come up with that title? It's quite imaginative.
A long brainstorming session.
Yeah. But
it wasn't that easy.
No. But there is a subtitle, as is often the case, and you have to look hard to find it, but it's called The Story of a Father Who Raised an Unlikely Baseball Dynasty. And I want to say that when you read this book, you'll understand how important that subtitle is. That's really a key to the book. And I think what I'd like to do is, Joan, as the co-author, maybe start with you and explain to the audience why that's such an important part of the book.
Well, thanks to the Commonwealth Club for having us here first. Benji and I just want to sort of start at the beginning. We're Benji and I first started to get to know each other through the Giants. One of the things Benji was the first to do was write a blog for the Giants. And so we wrote that together for 2.5 years. So I, you know, had the privilege of really listening to a lot of the family stories and really getting to know Benji a lot. And, you know, anybody who reads the book or, you know, knows Benji at all or either one of his brothers is... You know, there's just such a heart to these guys and such integrity and values, and it's real. So 2.5 years, and then, you know, breaking all of our hearts, he gets traded to the Rangers, and we continued to write the blog for the Rangers. But anyway, so Benji came to me with Jamie, his wife, you know, and this really was three of us collaborating on this book. And said, you know, I want to write about my father. And he was the first professional athlete. And I, you know, those of you who know my work, I was a sports columnist for a million years here. And it's the first time a professional athlete, you know, I have ever heard of anyone saying, I want to write a memoir about someone else. And it really... what drew me to the story, because there's a lot of good stories out there and writing books is really hard. And when Benji said that, and I knew his background and I knew what this man meant, to his sons and what he stood for, I just said, I'm in, you know, let's go. And what the key to the story is in a sentence is, it's a poor factory worker in Puerto Rico, who, through baseball, raised his sons to be great men. And that they became catchers, which is unprecedented in baseball, that three brothers, all catchers in the major leagues, and each one of them has won two World Series rings.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the hook.
Right.
And it's how that happened through this remarkable man who never left the factory to the day he died, and that his three sons, who have had all this success, look at him as the most successful man they've ever known.
Right. Benji, why don't you pick up on that? Because I think in your own words, why this was so important to you helps set the tone for us.
Well, I'd like to start by saying thank you. Just like Joan said, thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure for me to be back in the Bay Area. We loved it here. We love it here. It's one of our favorite cities. I was really upset when I got traded, but it's part of the game, as we all know. That's the way it goes. And I wish everybody good luck, and I was very happy that the Giants won. Very, very excited, very happy for a lot of friends. But going back to the book, it's more like a tribute to my dad and my parents, and all the sacrifices they had to make weren't easy. You know, as you guys are going to read about, my dad he had a great life. Don't get me wrong. He had a great life. He was doing what he wanted. He was very happy, very excited, helping kids, going to work, reading the newspaper in the middle of work. You know, he was having fun. He did everything having fun. And then plus, he got a chance to see us, all three of us, win a World Series. So he was great. He was fine. I mean, obviously, he passed away, and then I don't like talking about that part of it. But the book is very inspirational. We hope it motivates a lot of kids. And a lot of parents, obviously, a lot of parents are very important to get motivated and give the kid time so they can spend time with them. So I hope you guys enjoy it.
A lot of us spend a lot of time as parents trying to do the right thing, and it doesn't seem to come out that way. In your case, it clearly did. What was it about your dad that had that had the effect that you're describing?
Well, obviously, my dad didn't make us go to the major leagues. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not, and we understand that. But the principle, you know, the principle when we started playing baseball was about respect, respecting the game, respecting others, respecting everybody, but also showing us life, the real life through baseball. My dad was a man of very few words. Whenever he got a couple of Coors Lights,
yeah,
he will tuck your ear out. But but if he didn't, he was very quiet. But in baseball, he talked.
Yeah.
And we love that part of it because we never hear at home. We never hear him say a word at home or anything. You know, we just heard him at the field talking to all the kids and teaching them the game, and make sure you stay in school, and make sure you do all these things. And so through baseball, he taught us the way to live. And then after that, obviously, we did the rest, and mm-hmm. we worked hard, and we all made it. It's not a coincidence that we became catcher.
Right. Right. The normal assumption about people who come into the major leagues is that they are stars and just above, you know, the 100th percentile in terms of skill set and recognition all the way up through, and it's just a matter of when they are going to make it to the majors. You had a slightly different career path, but it's an important part of what you're talking about, so that's why I bring it up.
Yeah, it wasn't a very slight thing.
Right.
It was very big. I was called the almost, like I always told Joan. I almost threw 90 when I was a pitcher. I almost run 7.0 or below. I was 7.1. Believe it or not, I was fast at that time. all those things were always almost. I almost got drafted. The phone never rang. So all those things gave me a lot of power. I wouldn't say power. It just kept me going. I wanted to make it so bad. And then I just kept working hard at it. They call me a crazy horse because I would go out and I put a sock on my ear with my headphones on and my tape, cassette player.
Yeah.
And most of you remember that.
Yeah.
With my headphones of a little cushion deal almost fell out of my ear. And I went out running and I pulled tire on the field. I hit by myself and everything. I was going crazy. And
you
I wanted to make it.
That crazy barbell.
Oh, yes.
How'd you make that barbell?
The homemade barbell.
Yes, the homemade one. It was very funny. It's a cracker. It's like a, how do you call it, a can?
Yeah.
Cracker.
Kind of like the size of the oatmeal
canisters. Yeah, like that. And I did it myself. I mix up cement and I threw it in there. And then I pick up some rocks. I thought it was make it heavy. And I put the pole right in the middle and I left it overnight. Because the next day I was going to do the other side. And then when I woke up, the whole thing went the other way. So then I had to make the other one. I didn't care, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I make the other one. I put it up, and it went the other way overnight too. So here I am going like this, you know, like trying to, you know, one arm got stronger than the other, of course. But it was my weight, you know. It was something I used. I went into the trees, and I cut wood with the axe. I went crazy. I wanted to make it so bad, and I think God saw that and gave me an opportunity.
And I think, you know, just to jump in, you know, one of the things that motivated Benji as the oldest of the three boys is that his father was this, you know, sort of local legendary player in what was called the amateur leagues, even though they got paid. I never quite understood that part of it, but they did get paid, not a lot. And he was just this great player, and everybody had stories about Benjamin Molina. Everybody had stories about him. And, you know, Benji and his brothers grew up in this house that was filled with their father's baseball trophies. But as Benji got older and realizing, like, okay, you know, great players go into the major leagues, and you know, he's hearing about all these other Puerto Rican players going to the major leagues, and like, why didn't my father, you know, make it? And you know, as Benji's telling me these stories, I'm like, well, why didn't you just ask him? And you know, his father died, and Benji said, well, I thought that would be disrespectful. You know, it would make him feel bad that he had failed. You know, and I really didn't want to hear how he had failed. And then, so he kind of was one thing that drove him to make it to the major leagues was to kind of carry his father's dream. And if he made it, then, you know, he could carry his father's dream. And then, you know, sort of the central mystery of the book is that, you know, when his father dies, and he died on the Little League field
spoiler
across the street,
alert.
Right there at the age of 58, Benji only then, after that, and he goes sort of searching for these answers, he finds out why his father didn't make it. And, to discover that it was never his father's dream.
How did you feel when that realization finally fell?
It felt weird inside of myself because I thought that's what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So, but when I didn't want to believe it.
Yeah.
At first, I didn't want to. Inside of me, I was feeling like he wanted to play ball.
Mm-hmm.
But it was hard because a lot of his friends kept telling me the opposite, you know, and it was tough. It was tough. I thought baseball was everything for all of us, but it wasn't. You know, my dad was about family. He loved his sisters and brothers so much. And, you know, I learned that. And plus the guys, when he passed away, which by the way, he died at 58. And my uncles die at 58. So when I get to 57, I'm jumping to 59. Just so you know. Don't make fun. Yeah. So if you see me from 57 jumping to 59, there's a reason behind it. Yeah. Okay? Well, but it was sad and confusing at the beginning when I heard that. Yeah. You know, I didn't know what to think. But later on, obviously, it's more about a family. It's more about caring and making you know, helping kids and all that.
Yeah, it's an interesting paradox because parents spend a lot of time trying to avoid creating the sense of specific expectations for the kids, and the kids keep spending a lot of time trying to live up to the expectations that they are inferring their parents have for them, and that sounds like a situation. I bet he spent a lot of time trying to disabuse you of that.
He never mentioned the big leagues. This is one thing that I told Joan. I said, he never mentioned you're going to make it to the big leagues. He always say, you have to keep going on the process. You have to keep getting better, and then you'll make it. There's no way that I can tell you right now you will make it to the big leagues. There's no way on that. You know, the kids shouldn't know any of that because there's a process to it. And he made sure of us. He said, if you keep working hard, if you keep respecting, if you keep practicing, if you keep doing all these things, you'll have a big chance in making it. But don't jump ahead and think that you're going to be a big league player without going through the whole process. And that was one of the biggest thing that I got in my head, one of the biggest thing he put in our heads. We never talk about the big leagues. We always talk about when we were 7 and 8, we wanted to be the best 7 and 8 team. Hmm. But when we move up, we were 9-10s, we wanted to be the best 9-10s. Mm-hmm. So we were never, and I carry that through the minor leagues. Because you have that, when you sign pro, you have that major league right there, all over, every day, everybody's talking about, I want to make it. And here I am in the corner, you know, in the clubhouse, thinking, I want to be the best guy here so I can make it to the next level. And these guys are worried about big leagues, they're not even playing good here. So there was a lot of things that he taught us and we grabbed from him.
One of the lines in the book that I thought was a really good example of the types of lessons is when you talk about learning to deal with failure. Do you recall that about how if you have failure, you just have to learn to accept it and move on?
It's easier said than done, but it's true. Yeah. It's very true. And this goes in real life too.
Right.
This doesn't go because I play baseball. It obviously goes in real life. We all go through failures and struggles. But it's up to us. It's up to us to keep moving, forget about it somehow, and keep moving. And that was a good attitude that we were taught, you know. And you, as everybody knows, you get 10 at-bats, you fail 7 times, and you're a Hall of Famer.
Right.
So that's the only sport that failure, it's okay. So, you know, I think it's a good lesson.
Well, then the corollary of that is if you fail at 8 times and only get 2 at-bats, you're in the minor leagues. So everybody's in that range between 2 and 3.
It's funny because the last year I played, I started off great with the Giants. I was hitting very good for the whole month, and then I got hit on the left side with a foul tip, and I couldn't lift my bat. You know, I couldn't swing anymore, but nobody knows that. I mean, nobody knows what you're going through. And then, yes, of course, my average started going down. You know, and it was very tough. Bochy wanted me to catch these young kids as much as I could.
Yeah.
And I wasn't going to say no. I'd rather fail at what I was thinking, 3 out of 10.
Yeah, right.
I was thinking that when I would retire. But I'd rather fail that than let those guys down. And I wanted to catch, and I did.
Yeah.
But my batting average just kept going down, and that's when – this young kid, I don't know if you guys know him. You know
him. I've heard of him.
I never heard of him.
Yeah.
I don't know. He must be an MVP in Florida or something.
Yeah, I know.
Well, he came along, and then everybody started yelling, and the fans started yelling, "Posey, Posey," and I realized, and it's okay. So he'll be good.
Yeah.
You guys are in good hands.
But you ended up that year, even though you got a bad arm, you were a big influence on Lincecum, right?
Yes, I was. I hope I was a big influence in many of those guys, because I took my time, and my wife knows this. I took my time on talking to all those guys. When everybody was sleeping on the plane, I was doing my report, but I was also walking around talking to them. You know, I was talking about life. I would take my time and saying how to save money, how you have to live life with what you have. Don't live a life of a millionaire when you only get paid $300,000.
Yeah.
You know, so all those things, I became a brother to them. And I know I help them in baseball, but I'm more proud that I help them in life. And that's what we want with this book.
Yeah.
We want this book to be inspired, you know, inspirational and motivational to everybody. You know, that's what we want.
Yeah.
And not to, can I jump in? And not,
please.
You know, not to brag too much about Benji, but, you know, we all know what the Giants are now and what they started to become in 2008. Right. And then by 2010, you know, it's almost like the war. You know, I look at the Warriors and I say, you know, that's the basketball version of the Giants. They're just such good guys. And there's a culture in that clubhouse that Benji was very instrumental in helping to create. I mean, frankly, after Barry Bonds and some of the old, you know, guard left, and we had a lot of these young players, and you had a veteran like Benji who, you know, obviously he's Latin, so he speaks Spanish, you know, obviously speaks, you know, perfect English, you know, really was that bridge. And it was fascinating for somebody like me who's been in sports for so long to sort of just watch that shift in a clubhouse culture that ended up being, you know, what we've seen as three World Series. And you know, Benji, of course, and there's, you know, one or two other guys too, and Bochy, but, you know, you never see that. Like, you never know what those forces are at play behind the scenes that help create something that then, you know, comes to fruition a few years later. And you know, Benji was such a key part of that clubhouse. And, you know, and that's a key part of this book, too. And, you know, direct line back to your dad.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's the way we were taught. That's the way I saw it every day. He was drinking, playing dominoes with his sister, his older sister, one day. And I was there with him, and I saw him, and he couldn't pay for the round of the guys, and the guy were teasing him, right? It was like 6 beers or something. And he couldn't pay it. He said, no, I'm not paying. You got to pay today. I'll pay tomorrow, right? So, but what I saw from him, he took out a 20 and put it without my aunt seeing it, and he put it right in her purse. He had the money, he just didn't want to do it in the beer department. Yeah. He wanted to put it in the other one.
Yeah.
So, but that tells you how he is.
Yeah.
He took care. He would have been no money, but he wanted to help his sister. And I kept watching. I mean, and there's so many stories I could go on and on, but those are the ones that stuck to my head for me. And that's why I want to become him. In a way, I want to become him in baseball. But it wasn't that. It was more about him being a human being, a very, very well-respected man. And that's what I want to be. Mm.
I want to come back to that, but I want to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and we have the pleasure tonight of having Benji Molina, caught primarily for the San Francisco Giants, and Joan Ryan, who's a very well-known San Francisco writer, and they've produced a memoir of Benji's relationship with his family and his career in baseball at the same time. I want to come back to the point you made, because I wondered how you have three children, right? So how do you transfer what you learned by observing your father and mother to how you approach raising your own children?
Well, I always try not to see it the same way, because obviously we were taught through the game of baseball.
Right.
And these are three girls, and mm-hmm. it's a little, well, they don't wear spikes, right? Yeah. So I always try to think about that. And mm-hmm. But the best way that things have never changed is about respect.
Right.
You know, and caring for others. That doesn't mm-hmm. change.
Right.
I don't care where you are. I don't care where you work. If you have respect for others and yourself, and you care for people, you won't have no trouble. So I always try to live by that. My dad was very, very special on God first, family, and then respect.
Mm-hmm.
He taught us that the whole way until he died.
Mm.
And he taught so many other kids the same way. So yeah. I always try to live by it.
Yeah.
You know, like I have trouble with my oldest daughter because she wanted to date a kid that I didn't like.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
and she put God,
yeah.
boyfriend,
uh-huh.
and then family.
Yeah.
And no respect.
Right.
I cannot deal yeah. with that, you know? So
yeah.
I was upset, and luckily she gave him the boot. And, you know, after I almost gave him the boot.
Yeah.
So, but I try to follow my yeah. dad's footsteps. And
yeah.
and this is not only my dad. Like I told John before, this is not only my dad. You have to have your uncles, your aunts, your cousins be in the same boat. And they were. And you know, when we go back home, we take care of our family. And we do.
Mm-hmm.
We do.
Mm-hmm.
You're making me cry.
Yeah.
No, because it's you saw how they live. And it's not easy the way they live. It's
well,
my time.
As an example of that, based on my reading of the book, you and your brothers have tried to help support your father and your mother and provide them with a new Toyota and so forth. And tell us what happened when you guys tried to do that.
It's amazing. My dad is so macho. So I know if you guys understand macho, right? Unbelievable. That guy, he don't want nothing from us. He doesn't want a car. He doesn't want money. He doesn't want anything. He has three sons making good money in the major leagues. He wanted nothing. He said, I don't want your money. It's like, Dad, I'm trying to help you out for the lunches or your, you know, gas for the work. I don't need your money. I got money. I work.
Yeah.
He's like, dang it, how do I do this, you know? Then my brother tried to buy him a car. I don't need your car. Why do you bring me here? I'm going to buy you a car. Don't buy it. I ain't driving it. You know, so
yeah.
he was, and he'll tell you. He's not taking it. I try to send him catching gears and glove for the teams that he had.
Mm-hmm.
But he never won it, you know. In the other hand, my mom, she's different. She'll take anything. She will, literally. She'll yeah. take anything. She heard me talking to my dad, and my dad would say no, and my mom would be the one saying, oh, give it to me. It's okay. You know? So
yeah. yeah.
My mom is roughneck, like I always call her. She's rough, but she'll take it. She'll take the money, and then later on, she'll put it in his pants or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But my dad would never take that. And I yeah. bought him a nice watch, very nice watch. And he wore it out of the store, and that was it. That was it.
Yeah.
He passed away, and the watch was right next to his table where he sleeps. And I took it. I have it now. But it was nice, and he didn't want it. He don't want nothing from us. He was very proud of working, very proud of supporting his Gorda, which means fat lady. my mom. Yeah. And he said, why am I going to do this? I need to provide with insurance. If I don't work, your mom has no insurance. I got to work. I said, Dad, you don't have to. I'll put you in my insurance. You don't have to do nothing for me. Yeah. And he was that type of guy. Yeah. And he did it. He didn't care about that, you know, but he cared about family and he cared about his sisters and brothers. And that's what I want to take. That's what I want to be. That's what I want to be.
And when he died, the plastic was still on the seats of the Toyota, right?
Yeah.
That he never,
yeah.
Yeah, and the sun visor.
Yeah, the whole plastic deal, how it's new, that's how it was. Yeah. He didn't touch it. He didn't like it. He didn't like it, and he was not going to use it, and he was not going to drive it. But that's how it was, and obviously he's very much missed, but he served his time. He had fun in our life. He had fun, and he had a time to enjoy it. One little thing before we get going. I don't know if you guys know Roberto Clemente in baseball, yeah. Right? Very famous, very unbelievable guy. And that was one of our idols, right? So when he died, we meet with Camacho.
And when your father died.
When my father died, we meet with him. And he tells us a story that my dad met Clemente when he was young. He took him to the field. He shook his hand, gave him a hug, talked to him, everything. Clemente, I mean, this is crazy, right? And I never heard of it. I asked my brother right away when we found out. I called my brothers. Hey, did you know my dad met Clemente? And he goes, no. He never brags about anything. And if it was me, I would have told the whole city, you know? Yeah. Sorry, but it's true. I would have told the whole, you know, the whole city, hey, man, I met this guy, you know, he's very famous and, you know, but he never did. He never did. And that's the way he was. Yeah. That's the way he was.
That's a very telling story. One of the things I didn't realize was that you actually started out as an outfielder and shortstop, right? a shortstop who ran 7-0.
It wasn't pretty. Yeah. I thank God I became a catcher. How's that? Yeah. I'm very proud of being a catcher, man. It wasn't.
That's what
easy.
I'm driving at is how, what in your career converted you to catcher? Because obviously you blossomed in that position.
It's not a coincidence.
Stop.
It's not a coincidence.
Benji keeps saying this because Jamie and I, you know, try to give him some talking points. And one was, it's not a coincidence that my brothers and I all became catchers because we're the guys, you know. So that's why he keeps coming back to this.
Well,
I think he's just poking at us, isn't he, Jamie?
But it's true, though. It's true. I think, the whole story, very short. I never caught, right? I never, for 16 years, I never caught. Never had a catcher glove, not even for fun. My brothers, they were both catchers from 5 years old, but I never caught. And then one day I was almost done with baseball. And you guys are going to read about it. I think we're telling the whole story, but but you guys are going to read about it. And one day I was working at a factory already. I was at a factory playing amateur ball just like my dad was doing. And then a Saturday, finally my day off from factory work, my brother Jose had a tryout with the Angels. And then my mom was there, my dad was there. He was not going to sign with the Angels. The Angels wanted to see if they could draft him. They just wanted to see how good he was. And my mom, the day before, that Saturday, the day before, I played for an amateur team in my town. I went 4-for-5. I had a good game. And my mom, I came up in the paper, you know, saying, showing my picture and what I did and all that. Sorry. Then my mom was there. My mom doesn't know English. She doesn't know a word in English. Yeah. And then there's a scout, Puerto Rican scout and American scout that I could not say his name.
Point of it.
Point of it.
Do you know him?
Ray Point of it. I will never forget that. And then, but then he was there, and right when my brother's doing the tryout, my mom has a newspaper that I came up, and she goes right to the guy. It's like, "Hey, my son," you know, and in Spanish. And the guy's like looking at her like, "What the heck is she doing? You know, what's the newspaper about?" "And my son," you know. Yeah. And then the other scout said, "No, that she has another son, and he came up in the paper. She wants you to give him a tryout." And the guy's like, "Oh, I don't know," and on and on. And finally, my mom bugged him enough, so he wanted a tryout. He wanted to see me. And I was living at this time. I was living in a very tough neighborhood where a lot of gunshots, a lot of people yelling, selling drugs. It was very rough, very rough. And all of a sudden, I'm resting, watching TV, and my brother, I didn't know it was him, but somebody just knocking the door very hard. And I'm like, jump out of the bed, and I grab the bat, and I say, "Whoever comes in, man, I'm ready to go," you know? So I was so spiked up, you know? And my brother said, "Open the damn door, it's me, man, what are you doing?"
Yeah.
And I said, "All right, what happened? You scare me. I'm breathing hard." And he goes, I got you a tryout. You got a tryout." And I'm like, "Tryout? Well, I've done 78, 79. What the heck, you know? I can do another one." And he goes, "Yeah, the Angels want to see it. They're looking for a free agent." And I'm like, "Wow, really? For real? Okay, let's go." You know, I already threw my spikes up in the cables. And I'm looking at him just going,
"Yeah."
Right? And I'm like, "Oh my gosh, I don't have any shoes." And he goes, "Oh, you can use mine." It's like this big. It's like, "Yeah, sure. No, I look like a clown with this thing." But I used them. I have a picture actually of the uniform that I used that day. Mm-hmm. It was my American Legion baseball uniform that I used a couple of, like, a year before, so you guys would imagine how tight it was. So I went over. I took my infield glove, outfield glove, I never caught.
Yeah.
So I got there, warm up. I'm warming up, throwing with my dad. And then the guy calling me up, you know, "Hey, you ready or what? Come on, let's go." I said, "What? Let's go. All right, let's go." And he had a catcher's glove in his hand, and he threw it to me. And he said, "Here, throw to second base. Let me see how you do." Ooh, I look at my dad, and he goes, "What, you scared?" I was like, "Yeah, thanks."
Yes.
"Thank you." No, he goes, "You scared?" I was like, "No." He goes, "You seen your brothers catch and throw. Catch the ball, throw to second base. You'll be all right." I was like, "All right, thanks, let's go." I guess so. And I catch and throw. And I did really good. I did good, and that was a Saturday. Monday, I signed my contract. Wow. Tuesday, I was playing for the rookie ball in the Angels organization as a catcher.
Yeah.
That's how I became a catcher, other than the coincidence.
Yeah. Right. Thank you, Joan, for... Yeah. No, I think that's a fascinating story, and when you realize that you ended up winning two gold gloves as a catcher in major leagues, it makes it even more.
I could have won three more, by the way. We're not getting into that.
Yeah.
But I also love the image of this glove. It was like a Walmart plasticky kind of glove.
No.
And he's going into this clubhouse and everybody's got those gorgeous leather gloves. And you had to repair yours with crazy glue from the corner store when it started to crack.
I wish I would have saved it.
Yeah, that would
be
great.
I wish I would have saved it, because it would have been something really, really crazy. I think that glove, I don't know if you guys had experience with that, but I seen the glove, but I thought it was a great glove. I mean, I don't know anything about catching, so I thought it was just one of the best ones. It says Lance Parrish.
Right.
Said, "All right, he must be good."
Right. Yeah.
You know, he come up in the glove.
Yeah.
But then I caught my first bullpen, second bullpen, it just split right here. I'm like, is that supposed to happen? Or, you know, what do I do now? You know?
Yeah.
So I got crazy glue, and I started just going like that, looking at everybody, like, you know? So, But then I looked, like she said, I looked around, and it was Wilson, Mizuno's, and Rawlings.
Yeah.
I mean, it was so amazing. I'm looking at my glove like, wow, am I really catching with these? And but, hey, I didn't care. They would have given me a box of Twix, and I would have signed pro. I don't care. That was my chance.
But you also became a really good hitter, right? I mean, you...
I thank God. I always had, not when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. I couldn't hit the ball for anything, and I didn't have any power. I was very skinny, believe it or not.
Right.
I was very skinny, and I couldn't. The bats were very heavy for me, so I couldn't hit. I was very good on defense, first base, outfield, everywhere, mm-hmm. pitcher. But I was never good at in hitting. I was getting frustrated, but in the book you guys will read about it. But when I signed pro, I was already on my way to be a really good hitter. Mm-hmm. And every league, if you guys will see my baseball card, in every league I did pretty good.
Yeah,
good enough, you know, not great like guys like obviously Buster and all those guys that are supposed to be superstars. Not that tight, but I did good enough to keep moving on.
Yeah,
and that was it.
But you were also a timely hitter. I mean, you had a reputation for being, you know, the runner in scoring position with two outs kind of a situation.
I try to use my knowledge on catching.
Yeah.
I started using that a little more, and it helped me big time because I was finding out that it was easier to hit knowing or having a good idea what was coming. You know, and it's not easy to do. And my dad always said, you have to be smart hitting and you have to make adjustment during the at bat. And a lot of these young kids can't do that. Right. And that's why you see them having trouble with it. You know, they just go out there and if the pitcher makes a mistake, they're going to hit it. But if the pitcher makes a pitch, how are you going to get him? You know, that's the whole thing.
Just to throw a fact out, you have one of the best ratios between at-bats and strikeouts of any players. You struck out once every 14.2 at-bats. What was it that gave you that ability to avoid that strikeout? Was it what you're talking about?
Well, I think it's very simple. My dad one time told me, and told us, because I shouldn't say me, he told us, the team, if you hit the ball, you have a chance to get a hit. But if you don't hit the ball, you struck out, there's no chance to get a hit.
Right.
And we really took that very serious. Another thing that we did, there was a factory right by our house. And there was, I don't know if it happened here, but they usually threw out to the trash these little bottles, plastic bottles, like this big. And they're round, and they obviously something was in it. I guess they dump it out and threw it out, right? So those bottles, you throw it, and the ball goes right, like a wiffle ball. And we used to play all day with those things. And they're very hard to hit, obviously, because you don't know where they're going. And it's almost like a knuckleball. So we did that all our childhood. So I guess, you know, it contributes to having a good sight and putting the ball on, or put a bat on the ball.
Yeah.
So I think it helps.
One of the, we have quite a few interesting audience questions, and this kind of takes us into one of them, and that is why catchers seem to become such successful managers. Bochy is a perfect example. Bob Melvin across the bay is another catcher manager who's successful. Is there an explanation that you can help us with?
The easiest way I can put it is that the catcher is the only player looking that way.
In foul territory.
Yeah. In foul territory.
Yeah.
And we still count. So that's the best way for me to put it because I can see the first baseman, what he's doing. I can see the third baseman. If he's playing bad, I will move him. If I can see the shortstop, if they don't know their position, I can move in or doing something. So I'm always watching as a catcher. The outfielders, I will call timeout, and they know if I move my arm when I'm standing up, it's to move two step that way. Mm-hmm. If they know that I'm scratching move that way or come in if I go like that. And they know that I'm talking to them and not the shortstop or something. So, and obviously the pitching, we know what to call the game, how to call the game, how to, when they have an idea, when they do a hit and run, what counts they do it, what counts they like to steal. We have that in our heads just by watching the whole game every time. I think that's why we become good managers, because we're always paying attention to the games and we pick those little things always. I knew when Romo was going to throw strikes next pitch. When one time, I don't know if he does a steal, but when he lands and he always, oh yeah, like he's hurting his knee when he pitch, that's a fake. Don't believe that. That means the next two pitches are great and he struck him out. So Nick, don't tell him though, because he might mess him up. But pay attention, you watch. Yeah. When he goes, oh, my knee. Yeah. He's okay.
But, you know, the other thing we've talked about along those lines, too, and this, I think, is one of the more fascinating parts of the game of being a catcher, is that you have, what do you have, 11 or 12 pitchers on the staff. As the catcher, you've got to know the personalities, what motivates that guy, you know, what drains him, you know, who are you going to kick in the butt, who are you going to pat on the back. And to become a manager, now you've got to know 25 guys, really like 40 guys as they come up and down. And that really goes into how do you manage people? You really have to meet them where they are. And as a catcher, you absolutely had to do that.
You have to. You have to become brothers. You have to become a father, because that's what I felt like. I was a father to Lincecum, who was 16 when he came up, I think. all those guys were so young. They make me look so bad, but it's okay. But you have to become a father. You have to become a friend. Lincecum, you cannot talk to him really loud in front of him, because he's not going to give you the best. You know, you have to go around him and talk to him and put an arm around him and say, hey, what's up? You know, like things like that. But you know, you have guys like Wilson that every other word is a swear word, and you have to understand that. So it was funny. I always try to talk to Wilson like him. And I don't like to swear. You know, I don't like the swear words and stuff, but I sometimes found myself swearing over there. But it was because I wanted to be with him, you know, in the same level that he was. And that's how we are. That's how we are. And one of the funny things that happened to me when I first became a catcher in the Angels, Socia called me to the office and he said, hey, you know, he explained to me how I was the number one catcher and all that. And he said, but I want you to become the pitcher's best friend. And I thought, oh, I know them. I know. It's okay. No. I want you to become the best friend. I want to know what Washburn likes to eat, at what time he goes to sleep. And then he started pointing out all these things. And I'm like, what the heck am I going to do? How am I going to do that? So here we go. I go to Panda Express with Sean Wise. I go to somewhere else and eat with Ortiz. And all those pictures. Percival took me out to a bar. And I'm like, okay, and how do I ask this guy right here what he likes to eat? You know? So, and it's true. You have to kind of become one of them. And I did. I asked them on the flights, so long flights from California. I sit down with them and I asked them. I say, hey, what do you guys do? What do you guys like? Some guys like paintball, things like that. You know, so Socia kind of put it in my head. You have to become a friend.
It's interesting to note Socia was a great catcher also.
Yes.
So he didn't just make that up.
Right.
I was very lucky. I was very lucky he was the manager in 2000, because he understood me as a catcher. And if I didn't make the team in 2000, I was going to be okay, because he knows catching. That means I wasn't ready. I understand. But the guys before, which they don't understand any of the catching parts, you know, sent me down. I mean, that was a struggle for me.
I remind our radio audience again that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and we're honored tonight to have Benji Molina, a great catcher for the San Francisco Giants, and Joan Ryan, an author in the Bay Area, and together they've written a memoir about Benji and his relationship with his parents, particularly with his father. One of the audience questions that we have here is what you think about the new rules to protect the catcher on the collision at home plate.
Those are very tough questions for us, because I'm an old school guy and I love old school baseball. I can watch it. I can read about it. I don't care. I love it. And those guys didn't have that rule. But at the same time, you have to think about their safety, and it was getting out of hand. I believe that if the catcher is blocking the plate, let him get hit because he's right on the plate. But if the catcher is away from the plate, slide. Or if the catcher is on the other side, slide. But if a catcher is trying to block you, I understand that. Let him get hit. That's part of the game. And there's nothing wrong with a guy coming in and hitting a catcher in baseball. But it's wrong when the home plate's right here and the catcher goes for a ball over there and he's getting hit over there. And it happened to me with Jermaine Dye in Oakland. When the home plate was right here, the ball was going my way this way. And I went over there and I caught it and I tried to come back because I thought he was sliding. And when I turned, he's coming to me. And the home plate's over there. And he hit me. We both roll. He got a broken collarbone. That time. And I was okay. But what I mean is the home plate's right here. Why, if I'm going over there, why you have to go hit me? Yeah. See, those are the ones that I don't understand, and I don't think is cool at all. But if I'm a catcher, if I'm blocking you from coming in scoring, go ahead, take me out. I'll take my chances. But, I mean, I'm okay with either one of them.
Another related question people ask is the increasing use of TV replay to review plays and how that you're an old school guy. How do you feel about that?
I don't like it, but it's fair. Yeah. I think in the end, if you win the World Series because of that replay, you'll be you know, so excited. And if you're the older guy, so you'll be mad. And that's just how it goes. But I don't like it. I think it takes away from the real game that many, many other people like Willie Mays and all those guys play. Yes, they're going to make mistakes. The umpires always did.
Yeah,
they didn't have no replay. So why are you going to bring a replay? I don't understand. They're trying to make it fair. In that matter, I understand. But I'm an old school guy. I wish they just leave it how it was. And the umpire made a mistake.
Yeah.
Just leave with it, you know.
The whole World Series got turned down. I remember with Joaquin Andujar and the call at first base.
Yeah, first base in Kansas City.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It reminds me of a story that actually somebody mentioned, is that how you hit a home run, but because of replay, you didn't score a run. It's a story worth telling.
Wow, that was a good one. I didn't remember that one.
Yeah.
But I hit the – it was Bochy's fault. I hit the top of the fence in right field, which I know you guys are familiar, something coming out.
Yeah.
And that's a homer. So I got to second, and Bochy, instead of doing the replay before he took me out, took me out for a pinch runner. I don't know why he pinch run for me in the first place. But he took me out right away.
Yeah. But it had been called a double, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, the ball wasn't played.
Yeah,
in
but
double.
I mean, there was ambiguity about it. Yeah.
And then he took me out right away.
Mm-hmm.
And then he realized, hold on, I think that's a homer. And then he went and asked for the replay. So that's why it becomes that I didn't get a run score on my own home run.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would have made a difference on my Hall of Fame career.
Yeah. Yeah. That would also be a great trivia question, I think.
Yeah, that would be, huh?
Yeah.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, it'd be awesome. Another theme that runs through the book, of course, is your marriage with Jamie, who is here tonight, your wife. And it's such a poignant story about how you met. And if you could summarize for this, I think it helps people get a flavor as well about this book.
Well, everything started a long time ago when she kept harassing me. I didn't want to say it, but now that you ask, I was working, you know, like always. I was at the field in spring training, and I have this girl over me, and you know, she used to work for KCAL.
I'm going to give Jamie an opportunity to respond.
No, it's our story. It's so unique. Mm-hmm. My marriage was always bad, and I tried to survive it. Mm-hmm. And she always told me, "Stay home, don't do anything funny. Just stay home." But I knew that I only have one life, and I knew that my kids were gonna be happier like that. You know, they saw a lot of anger at home, and they weren't happy, and I could see that. But I tried, you know, like trying to follow my dad's footstep, you know, like respect and all that. But it came to time that I couldn't take it anymore. And in the nicest way, believe me, I talked to her and I told her, hey, this is not going anywhere, and let's just do it for our kids. Nothing bad. But going back to her, I was very shy. I saw her coming out of the clubhouse, and I saw her, and I couldn't believe it. I was like, wow, how beautiful she was, right? And I started running, and we were running forward. She was behind, so I turned around. I started running backwards so I could see her. That's how it started. We spent a lot of years being friends only, and that made our relationship very strong, very strong. And I think that's why when they say when you're young, don't get married right away. Because I was very young when I got married. I thought that was the right thing to do as a Puerto Rican. You know, I thought that I saw my uncles getting married and young, so I thought that's what I was supposed to be. You know, I don't feel bad that I did get married, but I feel bad that it wasn't the right time, but I didn't have anybody telling me that and giving me advice on how to do it. But later on, she helped me big time with my marriage going south fast. I didn't want to lose my kids. That was a big thing. That was a big thing. I didn't want to lose my daughters. And then she said something. She goes, just be happy. Do what makes you happy and be happy, and you'll be fine. And my mom was fine. My dad was fine with her. Before he passed away, we had a chance to hang out with him. And his whole fear was my daughters. How are they going to be? But finally, he realized it. He saw it, that Kelsey and Kishley loved her and hang out with her like nothing. And they were very happy. And my dad saw that before he died. And he told one of my friends, I think the kids are ready. You know, they'll be fine. And that's when I noticed, and you know, and that's when the marriage just ended. And I
bring it up. It seems odd to bring up a divorce and a remarriage as an uplifting part of a book, but it really is an important theme of this book, how you were capable of making that decision and moving with
your life. It was tough. Yeah. It was tough, but I took that as a motivation. That's a strong motivation to me. And I said, I was having trouble with this marriage. Doesn't mean I'm going to have trouble with my life. It doesn't mean because my ex is having all these fights all the time. It doesn't mean that you're going to have a horrible life for 90 years. No, find a way, you know, find a way. And that's what I was thinking. Mm-hmm. Find a way to do this right. And my girls were fine with it. So I said, now what I need to do is her. So we went and talked, and he hired a very strong lawyer. It wasn't easy.
Yeah.
But I talked to her, and we talked face to face. And I told her, it'll be better for our kids. It's going to be better. And she understood. She was fine. She said, all right, cool, let's do it. And up to today, she's okay. You know, we're not best friends, but she understands that I'm the dad, and I understand that that's her mom. So, and it's fine.
But the price of that, though, and what's so instrumental in the father-son story is that, you know, Benji's father really didn't talk to him for almost 2 years because he really felt like Benji was breaking apart this family, and, you know, family is the most important thing. And, you know, it really was such a growth period for Benji in, you know, everything was just how, you know, if it was his father's values and his father's opinion, this was the first time he went against his father. And what his father didn't understand was that Benji was making the decisions based on his father's values, that he was making the decision for family. And it took a really long time for your father to even, I mean, he didn't watch you play for all that time. He wouldn't come to the phone. I mean, it was, it just broke apart this, you know, I mean, it was heart wrenching for you for all that time.
It was heartbreaking because he, obviously, like you all know by now, he was all about respect. He didn't believe in any of that. He never believed in me getting divorced or anything. So for him, I thought he was thinking that I was failing him. Mm-hmm. And he didn't talk to me. He didn't talk to me for a while. And I hurt. I hurt big time. I stuck to it because I knew he didn't see us that many times either. So I knew that as soon as he see my daughters with Jamie and how everything is, they were going to be fine. But he didn't see me, so he couldn't talk to me. He was kind of getting upset, really mad. But later on, like I said, he saw them, how they behave with each other, and then he ended up loving it. It was fine.
Yeah, he finally came out and met Jamie for the first time and then went back to Puerto Rico, and 10 days later he died.
Wow.
So they were able to reconcile and see each other. And so the timing was just, you know,
Here's
really...
a story. I remember we were in the Phoenix hotel, and she brought him a six-pack of Coors Light. And he doesn't know any English.
Yeah.
And he started giving her, I mean, he took the beer from her. And he went, and he thought he was speaking English. Because that's what he hears, right?
Yeah.
And he goes, blah, 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 like telling her thank you. And we were all laughing, and that was amazing. Mm-hmm. But yes, he understood what was going on, and he was fine. But then he had to go home, and we all know what happened.
Yeah. Well, Benji, it's time for us to wrap up, but I'm going to ask you a question hopefully in an interesting way that will capsulize this book. And that is why you would say this is not a baseball book. This is a book by a baseball player.
Yes, it's not a baseball book at all. It's a family book, father and son, father, mother, son book, the relationship and how many sacrifices they make for us, which I'm very willing to make for my kids. And I hope and I pray that people that read it, get motivated for that, and we'll see a better world later.
Well, I can't think of a better set of words to draw the evening to a close on.
Well, I want to say something real quick.
Yeah.
A lot of guys these day, their motivation is money. Their motivation is buying a car. Their motivation is buying a great home, a mansion. For me, my motivation was my brothers. My motivation was my mom, and my motivation was my dad. I wanted to make to the big leagues, yes, to make money, of course, but for them. And that's a very precious thing. If you guys can think of that, find that in yourself. Don't put those material things in the head. Always motivate yourself for your family. It's the most important thing.
And I conclude... Thank you. Yeah. Those are even better words to end on. And so our Commonwealth Club event for the evening is concluded. And I thank you all very much. Thank you, Benji. Oh, okay. There you are.